from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
The Article 50 process is now underway, and in accordance with the wishes of the British people, the United Kingdom is leaving the European Union.
That was British Prime Minister Theresa May yesterday addressing the House of Commons after sending a historic letter to the President of the European Council, a letter that formally initiated the country's withdrawal from the EU. We'll discuss what Brexit will mean for Britain and the remaining EU countries, and we'll look ahead at what will likely be 2 years of divorce negotiations. It's all coming up on Forum after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Brexit has begun, at least on paper. Yesterday, British Prime Minister Theresa May sent a historic letter to EU officials triggering Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, formally initiating the country's withdrawal from the European Union. In response, European Council President Donald Tusk said, "There is no reason to pretend this is a happy day in Brussels or London." May's letter comes after the British public voted in June 2016, a referendum for the country to leave the EU, a referendum that had a record national turnout and baffled pollsters with 51.9% of Britons voting in favor of leaving the EU. In this hour, we talk with a panel of experts about what Brexit might mean for the UK, the country staying in the EU, and the US, and we'll preview what will likely be 2 years of complicated exit negotiations. Joining me first from London is Rob Watson, political correspondent for the BBC. Rob, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you, Michael.
Good to have you with us. I guess the place to begin would be just to ask what, well, as they like to ask often and phrase it, what's the mood there? I mean, with this divisiveness in terms of a very close vote and with the Prime Minister having been against Brexit, where do we stand in terms of what the Prime Minister has said, which this will bring somehow the country together?
That's a good question about the mood. And interestingly, at the very end of her speech to Parliament yesterday, commencing this process, the Article 50, the two-year divorce, there was a bit at the end where she said she understood that it had been very divisive and that people who had voted Remain were disappointed, people that voted Leave were very excited, but that now it was time to come together. And in a funny sort of way, it all rang a bit hollow. And it was a reminder, of course, that in calling people to come together for the country to unite behind Brexit, it just highlights that we are still very divided. So to get to the mood, of course, those who voted Leave are very excited. They tend to see this as the possibility of a new beginning. Quite a lot of Remain voters have got to the point where they're just sort of fed up with talking, hearing about Brexit on the radio and TV every day, and they just want it to just get on with it. But there are also a very large number of Remainers who are very, very, deeply, deeply unhappy about it. They feel that the vote, the referendum, the way things are going, said things which they really didn't like about their country. So we embark on this journey, and it is a deeply uncertain journey into Brexit as a divided country. There's no two ways about that.
Also, if you could maybe break down the timetable for us, this is a divorce that will take 2 years. This is one of the more complicated divorces of all time, in fact.
It certainly is. I mean, one wonders sometimes whether divorce is a is a particularly good metaphor, because, I mean, in a way, it's much more complicated than a divorce, because we're all going to be living in Europe together, and Britain wants a good relationship with the rest of Europe afterwards. And also worth remembering, 3 million or so EU nationals live here in the UK, and 1 million UK nationals live across Europe. So it is complicated, because there are two things that need to happen. First of all, yes, this divorce bit. Britain, the Europeans are very keen that Britain extricates itself from the European Union, pays any money that it needs, sorts out the fate of these EU nationals. But then we have this whole other issue of...
Forgive me, Rob, could I just break in here for a moment? Because since you mentioned money, sure. We're talking about really a figure as high as estimate $64 billion that Britain would have to owe. We're talking about commitments and pension settlements and EU officials and so forth.
Absolutely, and you can imagine how hard that would, how difficult that would be, because don't forget those on the Leave side of the campaign in Britain, they were driving around in a big red bus that everyone remembers saying, if you vote to leave the European Union, that Britain is going to get, what is it, something like $200 million back a week that we can spend on our national health service. So it's going to look a bit weird if you're going to have to pay $60-odd billion. I don't think Britain is going to have to pay that much, but the point is that this issue of the terms of Britain's leaving will need to be sorted. And now the Europeans say it's going to have to be sorted out before Britain establishes this new relationship with Europe. Of course, what Theresa May, what the British government is saying, no, come on, we need to negotiate these two things alongside each other. But as you can tell from the conversation we've been having so far, Michael, this ain't going to be easy.
No, it's not. And there's a good deal of concern, particularly about what's going to happen with trade and security. Let me ask you particularly about security, because the fight against crime and terrorism, the Prime Minister has suggested, might be diminished as a result of Brexit, and the MPs, a number of them, are accusing her of using security as a bargaining chip. How do you read it at this point?
Well, the government has been rowing back from that, saying we weren't really trying to threaten it in any way. We were just pointing out that just in the same way that Britain has and wants to have a close trading and security relationship with the European Union, we'd like to continue that in the future. I find it incredible, the idea that Britain would seriously say, look, we're not going to cooperate with you on terrorism if you don't give us a good trade deal. And I think you'll see the British government row away from that, because, for a start, the Europeans don't actually believe Britain would seriously carry out such a threat. So it's not much of a bargaining chip.
What about the fact that Britain is looking for a comprehensive trade deal here? I mean, they're going up against a lot of obstacles on that score, aren't they?
They are. Look, you know, in many ways, the dynamic of what we're looking at here, Michael, is quite simple. You see, Britain wants everything that it's always liked in the past about the European Union. So that is free trade, cooperation of security. And it wants none of the things that it doesn't like, such as being part of a sort of embryonic federal Europe, paying into that union, having free movement of people, high levels of emigration from Europe into the UK. And what the Europeans are saying is, look, you can't have a better deal outside the European Union than you had inside it. Now, over the next 2 years, we're going to find out whether there is some compromise between those two positions. But there's no doubt that Britain is making a huge gamble. And the gamble is this. It's that business will trump politics. What do I mean by that? The Brexiteers, the Leavers, Theresa May and the others, they're hoping that in the end, German car manufacturers and French wine manufacturers and all this sort of stuff, that they're going to be so keen to carry on trading with Britain that they will insist to their politicians that Britain isn't somehow punished for leaving the European Union. I mean, I think the reason to be sceptical perhaps about that is that one has to remember the Leave politicians in this country did what business didn't want. I mean, businesses, the vast majority of businesses in Britain wanted Britain to remain in the European Union, but the politicians on the Leave side didn't listen. So it seems to me that therein lies the gamble. What will win, business, trade, or politics?
Talking to Rob Watson, who is with us from London, political correspondent for the BBC. One more question, Rob, I'd like you to address before we say goodbye, and that is what's going to happen.
As many as you like, Michael.
Well, no, I've got a whole passel of them, but just I've got a whole panel though that waiting to weigh in here,
sure,
as well. But I'm just wondering what you think, or what you've been able to observe the effects going to be on the new independence referendum with Scotland, or for that matter, the 1998 treaty, the Good Trinity Treaty peace agreement in Northern Ireland.
Well, look. You know, does Brexit mean that somehow Scotland is definitely going to be independent in the next few months, or that somehow there will be a united Ireland and that the peace agreement there will break down? Look, you know, who knows? But I think the whole point about Brexit is that it has raised uncertainties in those areas where there was less uncertainty. I mean, it was very hard to see how the Scottish government, the nationalist government there, could have organised another referendum had it not been for Brexit, had it not been for the fact that the Scottish people voted one way or another. And it's very difficult to see that nationalist parties in Ireland, north and south of the border, would be talking about a united Ireland, whether if it hadn't have been for Brexit. So the point is, you know, it's raised these uncertainties. It's created strains on the union that is the United Kingdom. And the importance of that is that, again, you know, as Theresa May tries to get this good deal, as she tries to make this case to the European Union, look, we're a strong country, our economy is strong, you need us. You know, meanwhile, the Europeans are looking and saying, hang on a minute, she's struggling to keep her country together. And, of course, the population itself is divided. So that is the tricky position that Theresa May finds herself in.
Rob Watson, with us again from London, political correspondent of the BBC. Much appreciate your being with us, Rob. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Let me tell you who we're going to have for the rest of this hour this morning. I want to welcome a number of people from the nation's capital, that is Washington, D.C. David Rennie is Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. He joins us from Washington. Good morning, David Rennie.
Good morning.
Also say good morning to John Fonte, who also is with us from Washington. He directs the Center for American Common Culture at the Hudson Institute. Welcome, John Fonte.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. And let me also say good morning, although it's afternoon, of course, in Washington, to Costanza Stelz-Mueller, who is Robert Bosch Senior Fellow in the Center on the United States and Europe at Brookings Institution. And we welcome you to the program as well.
Good morning. It's noon here.
It is noon.
Pleasure to be on the show.
and glad to have you aboard as well. Let me begin, if I may, with you, Constance. It's Constanza, actually, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. I want to make sure. With the Brexit decision, I think you said when you first heard it you were crying in a shower in Berlin. Why were you crying, and have the tears pretty much moved away from you now?
No, I'm still sad. Look, I'm a foreign service child. I came to London as a 6-month-old, and I spent my entire elementary school years in British schools. So I have I had an English childhood, and I have a deep affection for Great Britain and British culture. Whenever I go to London, I feel sort of, you know, I belong here in some ways, in a very emotional sort of way. And I also, have an enormous interest in British security and foreign policy thinking. It's always been very, you know, very complex and subtle, and I've learned a great deal from it. So, yeah, I did actually, I was in Berlin on the day of the Brexit vote, and yes, I heard it in the radio, and I'd hoped it wouldn't happen, although I had a bad feeling. And then I did cry, and I still think that this is an incredibly regrettable thing to have happened to all of us, not just to the Brits.
Because?
Because I think it's bad for Europe, and I will, and I hope my Brexiteer friends will forgive me for saying this. I also don't see how really this is good for Britain.
Well, John Fonte, I think, says it is good for Britain. Let me bring you into the discussion here. You're in favor of this because of self-rule mainly and sovereignty, aren't you, John?
Yes, I think we should all step back for a moment. I heard the BBC correspondent basically talking. It's unhappy, deeply uncertain, very doom and gloom. If we look at the big picture, basically this is a historic moment in history. This is, and it's something to celebrate if you are a Democrat, if you believe in liberal democracy and democratic sovereignty. This is Britain reaffirming its independence, its democratic sovereignty. That's what Theresa May said in her letter. That's what Boris Johnson and Michael Gove said during the campaign. This is all about who rules, who governs. So this is a historic event on the level, let's say, of German reunification. It's one of the great events of the past several decades and something to celebrate first and foremost on the grounds of democratic sovereignty, the greatest right of all, the right of a free people to rule themselves. So the British have reestablished this and starting to reestablish it. And so it's a great, great historic moment, a great day.
Well, I mentioned earlier Donald Tusk, who's president of the European Council, and he responded to Theresa May's letter outlining how he views the negotiation process. Let's hear.
There is nothing to win in this process, and I'm talking about both sides.
in essence, this is about damage control. Our goal is clear: to minimize the costs for the EU citizens, businesses, and member states.
David Rennie, does that capture it for you, damage control?
Look, I think it does. And I think that, you know, in response to John Fonte saying this is about kind of who runs Britain, who controls Britain. So The Economist magazine, I spent 5 years in Brussels reporting on the European Union. There are versions of European federalism that some in Europe would like to create, a kind of European superstate. That would, I think, be too much of a kind of loss of sovereignty for Britain to bear. I think what I would say to your listeners who are sort of listening to this kind of seemingly kind of dialogue of the deaf, where some people are saying there's a tragedy, some people are saying we should celebrate this like German reunification and the fall of the Berlin Wall. I think that Britain has completely miscalculated the costs and benefits of belonging to the European Union. I think that Brexit politicians have lied to the British people about how much sovereignty we lose by being a member, and they have lied to the British people about how prosperous we will be after we leave. Because here's the bottom thing. I think that the British public undoubtedly voted to take back control. They loved that slogan. Take back control was the main Brexit slogan. But they didn't vote to get poorer. And they were lied to by Brexit politicians who told them that they could have everything, that they could leave and they would be just as prosperous, if not more prosperous. And I think that's wrong. I think on balance, not for sure, but on balance, the chances are that we will be poorer by leaving and we will count for less in the world. And I think weigh that against the undoubted loss of sovereignty of belonging to the European Union. I think it's not as severe as John Fonte is perhaps suggesting. I think only 10% of the laws on the UK's books are actually European Union laws. A lot of the laws are perfectly sensible things about, you know, what's a safe, you know, design for a car windshield. What kind of glass should you use? And, you know, the European Union says, well, so we can make it easier to sell cars all around Europe, we'll have a single standard, a European windshield glass standard. And actually, the truth is, if you're currently working in a British car factory making cars for, say, Nissan, the world, one of the biggest plants in Britain is a Nissan car plant, they're going to carry on using the European standard for glass in windshields, because if they want to have a hope of selling those Nissans to anyone in Europe, they're going to have to follow the European regulations. But after we leave, we won't have a say in setting those regulations, whereas at the moment we do. We're one of the big players in Europe. So I would step back from that kind of apocalyptic vision, just say this has been a mistake. We've misjudged our costs and benefits.
Let me go back to John Fonte on this. I'd like to hear your response, John Fonte, particularly about the regulations and the money.
Right. Well, I had a discussion here with the in Washington with the deputy. It was the deputy ambassador of the European Union, and asked him the question of what percentage of laws in most European countries come from or are initiated by the European Commission in Brussels, which is, of course, is an unelected bureaucracy, or which from the democratically elected parliament. He said 60-80% of the laws are initiated by the European Commission, the unelected commission, not by the democratically elected parliament. In Britain, it's at least over half of the laws in Britain are initiated by, not by the House of Commons, the mother of Western democracy, really, but by the European Commission in Brussels. So politically, this is Britain had sort of moved to what we almost could call post-democracy, and now this is a restoration of democracy. So that's on the political front. On the economic front, as far as Britain being poor, wealthier, stays the same. There's a lot of disagreement on this. We'll see. I'm sure David Remy knows, Wolfgang Munchau over at the Financial Times said this Britain really wouldn't be any poorer. Neither did two of Margaret Thatcher's key secretary treasuries, the checkers of the exchequer, rather.
Well, excuse me, John, Michael there was Washington, a lot of doomsaying about the effect on the economy. There was great doomsaying, but things have pretty much not gone
right,
that route.
Not too bad at this point, and we'll see. We're going to see that, but it doesn't appear to be at this point any doomsaying. Britain is, as often been mentioned, the fifth largest economy in the world. Britain now has the same ability as most countries in the world to do their own negotiating within the WTO. I mean, countries we're talking about, China, Japan, Korea, India, Australia, Canada, Brazil, Gulf, all these countries have signaled that they want to do business with Britain. Of course, so does the United States. It's not at the back of the queue. It's at the front of the line now, according to the new administration. So all of these countries, including the largest economy in the world, they're now interested in dealing directly with Britain, so that Britain should be in a very strong economic position. It has the chances, Theresa May says, to become a global power at this point.
Well, let me go back, if I may, to Constanze Stelzenmüller, and you've compared this Brexit that we're seeing unfold here to breaking away or leaving an international treaty, I mean, particularly because so many laws do intersect and connect. But also, you've also said that most countries sent their worst people to the EU, Britain sent their best. So the overall picture for you is one of kind of the nation going south, not only economically, politically, but in every way, isn't it?
Okay. Here's just to give you some context to what I said. One is that the Brits have, I think, throughout their membership in the EU, had enormous impact on the formulation of the rules in the EU that then bound all of the EU, including the Brits. So much for the unelected bureaucracy. I mean, that bureaucracy, by the way, is tiny compared to most national bureaucracies. And nation states, particularly sophisticated nation states with first-rate civil services, have sent their best people, and the Brits were masters at doing that. So the notion that Great Britain somehow was without influence on the content of these rules is just completely wrong for anybody who's ever looked at this. The other part is that as David just said, the reality is that sovereignty is in Europe, I think for most of us, is not so much about self-rule, which I think there is actually still a great deal of, but is about solving problems together. That is what gives us control. The idea of that Britain would have more control and more ability to solve its problems, particularly the ones that it shares with other nation states like terrorism, strikes me as somewhat fictional. And finally, I think a really important point is that a lot of the criticism directed in Britain at Brussels and the supposedly unelected bureaucracy there, I think could equally, with equal sharpness and accuracy, be directed at London. Britain has one of the most centralized governments in Europe, and the peripheries of Great Britain, Wales, Scotland, Northern England, all really feel that. And I wonder whether their problems are going to get any better with this. They're certainly going to miss out on the EU structural funds that they got a lot of while they were members of the EU.
Again, Constanze Stelzenmüller is with us from Washington, and so is John Fonte, and so is David Rennie. And we're going to talk more with David Rennie, but we'd also like to hear from you. And indeed, this is an opportunity for you to join in here and let us know your thoughts in the wake of Brexit leaving. We have Article 50. We also have really before us what has been described as the Great Repeal. And you may want to weigh in here. In fact, I invite you to do that now. Our toll-free number is available. That number is 866-733-6786. Your thoughts, your questions, your comments are welcome. Again, call us now from wherever you're listening or however, radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, 866-733-6786. You can join the program. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website and posting any questions or comments you might have there, kqed.org/forum, or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Again, talking with a number of people. We talked earlier with Rob Watson, political correspondent of the BBC, talking with David Rennie of The Economist, John Fente of the Center for Common Culture at the Hudson Institute, and Constanze Stelzenmüller, who is a Robert Bosch Senior Fellow in the Center in the United States and Europe at Brookings. When we return, we'll talk to David Rennie and we'll hear from you. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Well, the UK is setting out its plans to replace all European Union laws and thousands of European laws on everything from workers' rights to the environment are to be transferred into UK law as the country gears up for Brexit. It was a done deal yesterday, and we are talking about it with some experts. And I should mention that there's also this big question of British citizens who are living in the EU and EU citizens who are living in the UK, which Rob Watson, the political correspondent for the BBC, brought up earlier. There's also really a whole question about what's going to happen with the ending of the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice. And Labour has warned that it's being done without proper parliamentary scrutiny. So there are many questions really up in the air. And just for a moment of cross-cultural interest is the fact that the European Commission President, Jean-Claude Juncker, actually hit back at Donald Trump's support for the UK's withdrawal from the European Union, saying that he would champion American states that wanted to secede from the Union here. So let me go, before I go to your calls and emails, to David Rennie, who's with us from Washington and is with The Economist as their Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist. David, put things into perspective for us here. I mean, there's a lot that is going to have to be obviously sorted through here, and it's, in many respects, a pretty big mountain to climb.
It is. I'd just like to quickly, your other guest, John Fonte, claimed that Britain is somehow post-democratic. So to make it sort of I don't want to use too much jargon. So to help American listeners, here are some things that Europe has absolutely no say over, and I think they're pretty important things. So does Britain have to go to war or not? You saw this with the Iraq invasion in 2003. Europe split every which way. Europe had absolutely no role in telling people whether to go to war or not. Should we have nuclear weapons? That's our decision, nothing to do with Europe. Things like unemployment benefit, how generous they should be, how long they last. Should you pay to go and see your doctor? Should you pay to go and send your kids to school? Should you pay to send your kids to university? All of those are completely national things now. Europe has no say on them. Where Europe has tremendous say is on things like what chemicals go into paint, how long the rest period should be for a long-distance truck driver, what kind of fishing nets fishermen can use. Those things, undoubtedly, Britain has lost some sovereignty and Europe has a lot of say on those things. But here's the other thing. Even once we've left, and this is a big, big point, if we want to carry on trading with Europe, and remember that half of everything sold, exported by Britain goes to Europe, we're going to have to obey a lot of those European rules. Otherwise, we're going to be using different standards. But they're going to be set without us having a say. So please avoid this kind of talk of Britain somehow being this kind of colony of Europe or post-democratic. Europe is extremely powerful in some very limited economic areas. And Britain is still going to be subject to a lot of those areas after leaving. So avoid, I think, the big sort of ideological sweeping statements about, you know, taking back control and sovereignty and freedom. This is a business relationship. We should judge it like that. And I think that we're going to end up, you know, losing out. But it's early days. We don't know yet.
David Rennie, I do want to go to our listeners. In fact, we're getting a lot of people weighing in on Brexit generally, and I want to read some comments. But first, perhaps you can respond to a question from a listener named Jeffrey, who says, now that we know just how deeply the Russians have meddled in the American presidential election, does anyone think that Russia could have swayed the election on this referendum?
No, I don't think there's evidence of that. We have evidence of Russian meddling in other European countries, say France, we've seen that, Germany.
Holland as well, yeah.
Holland as well. The truth is that it was not mysterious what happened. I mean, the British tabloid press have been pushing this for a long time. The British Conservative Party have been split for a long time. There is a tremendous amount of hostility to Europe in Britain. We didn't need an outsider kind of nudging us over the line. I mean, Donald Trump encouraged British voters to vote for Brexit, and I don't think that swayed them either. This was a domestic mistake.
And again, it's the European Commission President, Jean-Claude Juncker, it's pronounced Juncker, and he said the newly elected U.S. President was happy that Brexit was taking place and was asking other countries to do the same. He told this to delegates from the pan-EU Christian Democrat group in Malta, and he went on to say, if it goes on like that, I'm going to promote the independence of Ohio and the exit of Texas. Let me, before we go to your calls, just read a couple of comments here, pro-Brexit and anti-EU. One is the pro-Brexit comment from Tom, who says, so what if they are a little poorer? They have freedom and sovereignty. That is how the United States was founded. The Brits should be proud. Another listener, anti-EU, says the European Union was a huge mistake. It was created to enrich big money, banks, and the elites while destroying the middle class and sending most people into bankruptcy and poverty across Europe. And by the way, the legislatures in Europe are going to have to vote on this as well. But let me go to your calls, and let's begin Frank, with you, you're on the air.
Good morning, Michael. I have a question. Nigel Farage and some of the Brexiteers have these dark conspiracy theories that the government, because the ministers were, I guess, in large percentage against the members of parliament, I'm sorry, against the exit, will just nibble it to death bureaucratically by delaying and causing obstacles. What's the opinion of the panel as to whether that's not paranoia, but it might in fact happen?
Well, John Fonte, how do you read that?
Well, it looks like Theresa May is proceeding. I would dismiss that. I'm not too concerned with that. Theresa May is proceeding. She has strong support in the country. There's, as you know, a very weak Labor Party. Labor leader is very weak. So she's in a very strong position. I did want to respond to my colleague's comments just very briefly. Constanza said that Britain had, you know, a great deal of influence in the EU. My source for saying that Britain did not have a great deal of influence was Nigel Lawson, the Chancellor of the Exchequer. He pointed out in 72 key decisions of the European Commission, Britain lost every one, 72-0. He said, so that's not a great deal of influence. And David Remy, when he was talking about what the EU, where EU authority is and European authority in general, he didn't mention the courts. So they have a situation as if their Supreme Court is a foreign power. It would sort of be like if the United States, if there was a Court of the Americas in Buenos Aires that could overrule the American Supreme Court. So that this is both the case with the European Union Court and also the Council of Europe, a different organization, with the court both in Strasbourg and Luxembourg. One's EU, one isn't. But both of them have tremendous influence, and this can determine whether Britain can deport terrorists or not. So control of their security. So it's a very important power that is being restored to the British people.
John, could I get, first of all, Constanza to respond to what you said about those 72 deals, and then we'll hear David Rennie on the courts?
Sure, go ahead.
Constanza?
Okay, I'd actually do it the other way around, if I may. I'm a lawyer, but I haven't been a journalist stationed in Brussels. So on the commission victories, I only know that there are different numbers out there that contradict that. But I also am skeptical of that kind of statistic in general. Again, because I know from experience, because I've met them, just how senior and how sophisticated the British civil servants were, and that they often, and I think with all the support from Number 10 Downing Street, landed in key decision-making positions in the Brussels executive. But the courts are important. There are, of course, British judges on both courts, the European Court of Justice and the court attached to the Council of Europe. So Britain has had
majority.
A hand in
has.
Look, it was, I believe, the framers of this, of your country's constitution that enshrined the principles of separation of powers. Which is meant to control, to enshrine limited government and to end unlimited majoritarian rule. So there is a role for the courts in the balance and separation of powers. And if the British have a role in manning those courts... Yes, but you know what? Again, we are, the European Union is a not a super federalist organization, but a halfway house, if you will, between nation states and federalism. And all I'm the key point that I'm making is that the British have had a great deal of hand in shaping the jurisprudence of these courts. The other thing is, you will have noticed that the Theresa May's Brexit letter has a reference, a veiled reference, to Britain continuing to accept the jurisprudence of the European Court of Justice. So they're clearly not trying to get out from under that.
Well, let me go back to the deal that John Fonte alluded to, David Rennie, and I want to go to you, and then I want to bring a lot more callers on, as many as we can. But how badly do the British need a trade deal, and what kind of leverage do they have, as you see it?
So here's an important point. So take the American, you know, the role of America here. So Donald Trump has completely changed American policy rhetorically. He said that Britain would be, you know, front of the queue, whereas Barack Obama said last year that because America prefers to do trade deals with groups of countries, that a single country, Britain, would find itself at the back of the queue. So you have Brexiteers saying, hooray, you see, America is our best friend. We're going to sign a trade deal immediately, as soon as possible, with the US and the UK. Here's a problem. There's a practical problem. I mean, there's a legal problem, but, you know, you can exaggerate that. You can do a lot of, because Britain legally can't negotiate a trade deal yet. But that's not the important issue. The important issue is this. When the Americans and the Brits actually sit down to work out what they can agree, the first question that any good American negotiator is going to ask is, by the way, if there's an American-owned factory in the UK, what happens to its products when they cross the English Channel and are sold to, say, a German customer? Can you tell us what will be the terms of trade across the English Channel? And if the British response is, we'll have to get back to you on that because we don't yet know our relationship with Europe, then there's really nothing sensible for America to discuss. So you can talk in windy rhetorical terms about Britain and America having a great deal to do, but until the Brits have done the really hard thing, which is work out their terms of trade with Europe, there's really nothing for America to discuss. The terms of trade with Europe, what you hear from Brexiteers is that because Britain sells more to Europe, buys more from Europe than it sells to Europe, somehow we're kind of the champions of that relationship. Well, I buy more from Safeways than Safeways buys from me, but that doesn't give me the whip hand because they're larger than me, and Europe is larger than Britain. And the argument that Europe is going to listen to, say, as you said at the beginning in your introduction, that somehow the politics is going to be trumped by German car companies and French winemakers saying, telling the French and German governments to give Britain a sweet deal of perfect access to the single market with none of the costs. That mistakes something pretty important, which is there's politics on the other side of the English Channel too. Just as Rob Watson from the BBC said, we have politics, populist politics in the UK, which has meant that we're leaving, but the French and the Germans have politics too. They cannot give Britain a better deal than any member of the European Union out of the European Union. You can't have access to the tennis courts of the country club if you're not prepared to pay the fee, because otherwise the existing members of the country club are going to rebel.
David Rennie with us from Washington, is Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist with The Economist. And let me go to more of your calls. And by the way, I'm just looking at a comment here that I can't resist reading. This is Owen, who Owen writes, I have dual U.S.-UK nationality currently. I wish I was Canadian. Sorry, I know, John Fonte, you wanted in here. Let me first get a caller in here, though. That's Manoush. Manoush, go ahead.
Hi, this is Manoush Birang. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question for your panel. My thinking about what's being said, my opinion was that the fundamental reason that the European Union was formed to give European countries enough socioeconomic power to compete in the world stage with China and U.S. and so forth. Now, those fundamental reasons have not gone away. So this was really to set up for future eyes of the Europe and European countries. If the fundamental reasons have not gone away, I don't understand what has changed for Britain to back out at this time.
We are raising an important question, and thank you for that. Actually, I'd like listeners to hear a clip. This is former British Prime Minister Ted Heath celebrating the UK joining the EU back in 1973.
Thus, this ceremony today marks an end and also a beginning. An end to divisions which have stricken Europe for centuries.
Well, we go back to you, John Fonte.
Okay. Well, it's interesting. He's saying more integration means more harmony. Well, actually, the opposite has happened the last few years. We see with the introduction of the euro. Fortunately for Britain, they're not in the euro. But the euro has led to tremendous tensions within Europe. Germany and Greece don't have the same economy, don't have the same work ethic, the same culture. They should not have the same currency. And you know, say Britain's decision not to enter was good, but more Europe, more integration has led to less democracy. The point I was going to make, just to answer to David, who keeps talking about politics, 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 I would substitute the word politics for democracy. And that's what we're talking about. Democratic self-governments, decisions that people make. So when I hear the word politics, I just substitute the word democracy. And he's essentially saying that the position of the Economist is that money trumps democracy. Well, I guess we're going to see. We're going to see in the negotiations, and we'll see in how the British economy develops and how this global Britain of Theresa May, how it starts working with other countries, both to improve their economic situation and politically, most importantly, to allow them to rule themselves.
Again, John Fonte directs the Center for American Common Culture with the Hudson Institute, and here is Josh. Josh, thank you for waiting. Join the program.
Hi. My question is just, what is the sheer expected economic cost of having to spend 2 years of negotiating and every person and business in Europe not knowing what's going to happen in the next couple of years?
Let's talk about economics, and let's go to David Rennie of The Economist on this. We mentioned before that there may be a $64 billion debt, but what about just the whole negotiation cost? Can we estimate?
Look, it's going to tie up the British government to an astonishing extent. I mean, just to respond to the point that I'm putting money ahead of democracy, no, it's the exact reverse. I'm saying that because there's democracy in the continent of Europe, that's one big reason why this negotiation is going to be hard. John Fonte also said that Britain doesn't use the euro. Well, it doesn't, and that's proof that Britain actually had a democracy, that Britain has, you know, border controls that other countries don't maintain. Britain chose not to join the euro. This is not a dictatorship telling us what to do. There will be tremendous opportunity costs. I think one of the tragedies, I would say, is if you look at the map of the UK and you look at who voted to leave in the largest numbers, some of the towns that voted to leave in largest numbers are places like Sunderland. It's a factory town in the north of England. What is the single most important thing in Sunderland? It's a gigantic car factory, a foreign car factory owned by Nissan. Now, Nissan will have to decide in the long run whether to stay or not, and that will clearly be very affected by whether the cars made in Sunderland can be sold to European drivers as well as British drivers. And that is something that will depend on European standards and decisions taken in Europe as well. And, you know, Britain, this idea that the only thing that matters is kind of a pure abstract idea of sovereignty and democracy, plenty of things that are good affect your sovereignty and democracy. For example, the obligation not to commit war crimes, you know, some of the Geneva Conventions on refugees, some of the courts that John Fonte talks about, that listeners heard about, that say do have a say on whether you can deport a terrorist. They can't tell you whether you can or can't, but they can certainly, you know, limit the ability to deport some terrorists or give them extra appeal rights. Actually, we're not leaving that court, because you know why? That court is part of the European Convention of Human Rights, which was written after World War II by the British because of the horrors of World War II. And that court is going to remain in place, and those judges are going to remain in place because, you know, we do believe in international law as well as domestic law. And there are costs and benefits to this. And again, I come back to this point. Please avoid these kind of absolute all or nothing principles. This is always a cost and benefit. And I would argue against misjudging our costs and benefits.
Well, your caveat perhaps ought to be followed with one from one of our listeners who tweets, stop saying the majority voted to leave. Only 72% of people voted. Therefore, only 36-37% voted to leave. And some more comments before I go to more of your calls. Christy writes, I have been dismayed by the lack of discussion on the historical background leading to the formation of the EU. Countries like England, France, Germany, and others overcame the deprivation and carnage from World War II to form a trade partnership for the common good. To turn away from that and make a return to isolationist policies will only lead to another European war. And Allen writes, a nation state should be able to control its own immigration policy. When immigration is used to economically undercut the interests of labor, it should be expected that the electorate would eventually take steps to alleviate such pressure. And let me bring another caller on, and that's Frederick. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Michael and guests. My comment follows those two notes that you read, Michael, about democracy and the threat to democracy of globalization. It seems to me that the dissolution of or the Brexit and the problems with right-wing nationalistic movements like here in the United States and Trump's win are the outcomes of a monetization and an internationalization and a privatization of countries' economies, that we have fallen prey to international banking that bankrupted the Western democracies in 2008 and 2009. And it sounds like we're dancing around the bush if we do not address the root cause, which I see as being the lack of self-destiny in Western democracies. One other comment I wanted to make is that the World Happiness Index that came out of the United Nations recently found that the 10 happiest people, the societies of people, live in Western socialistic democracies like Denmark, Norway, Iceland, Canada, Australia. And I'd like the commenters to contrast what their happiness shows in comparison to the disillusionment that most people in Western democracies feel.
Well, thank you for those comments. Before we go to happiness, though, and let me go to Constanze Stelzenmüller on the whole international globalization question, which is the first thing that caller brought up here. How do you see things in that lens?
Okay, this is a really important point. I think that we have, and this is where I think things we do have to realize that people who have espoused globalization and deep economic integration, which has indeed done a great deal to make Europe more prosperous, have perhaps not realized that that has also had downsides for some people who have become disaffected and alienated and feel that nation states are ignoring their problems. This is, by the way, a problem that exists in America as well with the manufacturing and the mining industry. However, it's really important to make the point as well that some of those changes in the labor market are not so much due to globalization as to what you could call the fourth industrial revolution, the automation. The fact that the trucking industry is on the cusp of being revolutionized by driverless trucks. That is something that can happen in a domestic economic space and that you can't really blame globalization for. And the thing is, of course, for a small European country, say many of Germany's neighbors, this deep integration, this globalization, the ability to be to trade without boundaries with the rest of Europe and beyond it, has made the difference between no growth and a great deal of growth and prosperity. In other words, you will find that attitudes to deglobalization and what is being called economic sovereignty are very different in those smaller countries.
Constanza, we began talking to you about crying in the shower in Berlin. Do you think that, I'm not asking to read tea leaves here, but do you think that the happiness index among people in the UK is going to go down because of Brexit? Is it inevitable to go down?
I should probably just stop talking about my emotions about Brexit and stop mentioning that story about the shower. But, I honestly think that I don't take the happiness index particularly seriously. I think that what we all should be striving for is decent governance. And that means a functioning social contract, markets that allow for a certain degree of equality and fairness of access, and political institutions and processes that work for everyone and that exclude no one permanently. There are different ways of doing this across Europe. The EU has certainly not led to some kind of a homogenization or pasteurization of governance in Europe. We have very different structures. And I honestly think, again, that the Brits have been angry at Europe for problems that are very much domestic in nature and that remain to be resolved. In other words, to take David's point up, whether the citizens of Sunderland are going to be happier outside of the EU than in it remains to be seen and, frankly, is for London to decide and always has been for London to decide.
And let me bring another caller aboard here. Kevin, thank you for waiting. Join us.
Yeah, hi. It seems like the taproot problem is nationalism, this retreat into a smaller tribe, and it's got a whole racist component. And Putin supports this kind of thinking in all the Western democracies. I would propose that instead of patriotism, we start to transition to matriotism. Instead of loving one part of the planet, let's love the whole planet, and let's be one family. This is a spiritual issue underlying all of this conflict-driven politics, and I think we can see the connection between the United States and what's going on in Britain.
All right, Kevin, I'll let that stand as an editorial comment, and I'll go back to John Fonte. And John, a listener, tweets, he says, one of the guests, I believe it was you, John, called this a win for democracy, and this listener wants to know, how can it be called that if the Brexit campaign was based on misinformation?
Well, I don't accept that it was based on misinformation. It was based on the information that we are going to decisions are going to be switched from the European Commission to the British Parliament. I think there was no misinformation here at all. What's interesting in our discussion is two of the my two colleagues have not emphasized, and 10 years ago they would have, the euro, how beneficial the euro would have been for the world, for globalization. Now we see that this the plunge into the euro has not been beneficial for large members of the working class and the middle class in Western nations. The euro has not been beneficial for Southern Europe, for Italy, for even for France, or for certainly not for Greece or outside of Germany and Austria, perhaps, and maybe some of the northern countries. the euro has not been of economic benefit or necessarily a political benefit. Again, getting back to the democracy point, what we saw with the euro was the removal, the forced removal of a democratically elected leader in Italy, Berlusconi. I mean, you could agree or disagree with him personally, but his removal was undemocratic, and this was done at behest of basically the sort of the fiscal policy, the idea of fiscal integration within the euro. So the euro is a key part of European integration.
John, I'm glad you brought up the euro because we're running short on time here, but I want to actually talk about it with you for a moment, if I could, David Rennie, because, and I'm looking at a comment here that ties in, a nation state, Alan writes, should be able to control its own immigration policy. We haven't even mentioned immigration. When immigration is used to economically undercut the interests of labor, it should be expected that the electorate would eventually take steps to alleviate such pressure. David Rennie.
On the euro, you know, that's for another discussion. Britain's not in the euro, so don't try and use the euro to justify a Brexit argument. On immigration, it was clearly a massive issue, and there are trade-offs. There is no doubt that a lot of British people dislike the fact that being a member of the European Union meant that if you're another European Union citizen, you can move to the UK, and if you can find a good job, you can do that job. Now, I would argue that that's basically been a net gigantic benefit. We've had a lot of very talented, hard-working, skilled Europeans moved in. If you go to a National Health Service hospital in the UK, one quarter of the staff are foreign-born. Most of those are Europeans. You go to every primary school, you know, lots of the kids are Europeans because their parents are working in towns and paying taxes. Lots of the teachers, lots of the teachers' assistants are Europeans. You know, it's been a huge shot of energy and high-skilled, hard-working people into the UK. I happen to like the way that Europeans have helped the UK economy become dynamic.
We're going to have to leave it there, David Rennie. I'm sorry to say, because we have come to the end of the hour, but I much appreciate all of you being involved. David Rennie again from The Economist, John Forte from the Center for American Common Culture with the Hudson Institute, and Costanza Stelzenmuller, who is with Brookings Institution. We also spoke with Rob Watson from the BBC. And we do appreciate your being with us. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated in the evening, 10 to 11. And Forum is produced by Irene Gucci, Tina Larberg, Susan Britton, Jeremy Siegel, and Judy Campbell. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer, Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Devin Holt and Stephanie Roberts. Executive producer is Holly Kernan. Thank you for listening. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.